wanted to offer you some thoughts about thoughts in meditation. And this is a perennial topic because it's a big reality for a lot of us. Just what do we do when thinking arises? And tonight we're going to look at it from, and I've actually offered some teachings about this several times over the years. I kind of realized I did it intuitively, and I went, oh, wait, I've done something before, but I've got sort of a different track I wanted to pursue from almost kind of a practical understanding, but also relating a lot to not self, and some approaches that I hope will be helpful for you all, which is always, you know, it's always my goal with all of this. Make sure recording's working. Yes, it is. So, you know, the fact is, thoughts arise. We're human beings. We're wired. We have evolved to sort through phenomena and to analyze phenomena, to structure things, to plan, all that stuff that we do to navigate life. We complicated human beings, and this is, you know, the vast complexity of human civilization for thousands of years, all the beauties of art, all the horrors of war, all that stuff comes out of thinking. So it's just so embedded. It's so much a part of who we are in the earth, and then how we nuance relationships with each other. I mean, that's a huge, huge, huge part of everyone's realities. That's what everyone just talked about. You know, how we do that, how it feels, the touch points, the hot buttons, the listenings, all that stuff, and how we think about it is really important. So I say all this to say, thinking is not bad. You know, thinking is part of what we do to navigate. And as a mental formation, it's the fourth of the five aggregates, or part of mental formations anyway, is thinking. So it's a way in which our sense of self arises out of our thinking process. And it's a recognized part of us. But at the same time, we're on a spiritual path. And how's all that fit together? So we create a sense of self through our attachments. That's just how our human process is. That's what the Buddha taught, the five aggregates. We create a sense of self. But to what degree that is true, it's complicated. And everybody get tripped up. This misunderstanding of thinking that arises, somehow being or inferring that there's a me, myself, and mine that's actually there. Because when we're mindful of our thinking, when we're in our world of thinking, it's one of the areas we really concretize ourselves around. That's me, thinking. And we get really stuck there. Consciousness is even subtler, but thinking's a big one. And people just concretize around their sense of, you know, their will, what they're going to do, all these different mental aspects we all tend to get ourselves stuck around, and that can cause problems depending on, you know, how life goes. And it's really interesting that in terms of this area we're exploring, and from his own experience with meditation, the Buddha described the fact that we cannot control this aspect of ourselves in the second sermon in Sarnath. He said, volitional formations are not self. For, bhikkhus, if volitional formations were self, then these volitional formations, a long word for saying the whole part of our mind, that the whole part of us that is planning mind and thinking and all these things. If they were self, these formations would not lead to affliction, and it would be possible to have it of these formations. Let my formations be thus, let my formations not be thus. But because they're not self, these formations lead to affliction, and it is not possible to have it of volitional formations. Let my formations be thus, let my formations not be thus. This is a pattern he went through for the whole, all the five skandhas, like your body. You know, if you think your body's you, if it was really you, you could say, oh, body, be like this. All of you folks with broken bones, you could just say, you know, be healed, boom, and fix them. But it's not. You're sort of, we inhabit a body and it does what it's going to do. So in all these aspects, we don't have control. We're sort of dancing along with these phenomena that are arising. And it's the same with our thinking. So we're not our thoughts. They're not somehow an inherent self. They're a phenomena that's happening. And we can consciously choose to think at times in some ways, but as we all know, especially from meditation practice, a whole lot of times it's just happening. And we're just sort of along for the ride. I mean, it's kind of almost embarrassing or hilarious, the degree to which that's the case. It's like, you know, it's kind of like if we were stuck in a room with 100 squirrels, could we control them? Right? They're going to do what they're going to do. Our thoughts are like that, pretty much. To a significant degree, they're going to do what they're going to do. So have you ever noticed when you're practicing how it seems like that? Like, oh my God, just stop already. You know, just all these things arising and passing and whatever, squirrels or monkeys or whatever, you know, you wish you could just control it. And we're going to nuance a little bit. There's some ways in which we can have something to do with what's going on. And then there's other ways in which we practice with what is going on. And that's part of how we can navigate this. Because the squirrels of our mind have their own agendas and busyness, and they do what they want no matter what we think about them, very vibrantly. That's kind of how our thoughts often are. And to be sure, we were just talking about this, touching on this a little bit, or I'm sorry, what's your name again? Because you're new and I can't quite remember you. Freeman was bringing it up in the tea, which was water because it's still pretty hot. You know, the balance between shamatha or absorption, samadhi, and mindfulness is another perennial discussion. And it's a different people are able to cultivate different depths of stability of attention. And that is great. And it's something we can all work on. But the wonderful thing is mindfulness works even if that isn't happening very well. And they feed back and they help each other. And this is not about shamatha. This is about how we're working with our thoughts. But I just want to say that up front, because there's times for all of us that things just settle down. And that's great. And some of you may have much more stable aspect of that than others. And I just, over the years, I've come to accept, you know, some people it really is, I won't say easy, but it's kind of second nature. They can go kalunk and settle right into a stability. And other people can't very easily, or maybe they haven't been able to for years very much, but the practice still works. Either way, that's the beauty of this mindfulness practice. About the chattering of the mind, Buddhist scholar and teacher Andrew, I don't know how to pronounce him, Olinsky. He was for many years director of the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. And he said, the riot of conceptual proliferation is often the first thing one sees because it is the shallowest and busiest part of the mind. For most of us, the monkey mind chatters incessantly as it swings from one branch to another, seizing first this thought, then that idea, then a host of miscellaneous associations, memories, and fantasies. So, and this is someone who's worked with meditators for years and years and years and teaches. And he's just saying, yeah, for most folks, that's how it is. And you know, we're not monastics. I mean, the Clear Mountain monks just got out of a two-month retreat, which was quite focused and solitary. Ajahn Kovalo is doing like 10 hours of practice a day during part of it. And that's just what they were doing. You know, he wasn't even going in for meals so he could be focused. He's very good at fasting. He went for days just fasting and practicing. So that's pretty amazing. And that's why they're monks, because they don't have any busy stuff. You know, they don't have children and partners and houses and bills and jobs and all that stuff. That's why people become monks. And it's wonderful. Harder to get shamatha for most of us. But we can really work skillfully with this phenomena of complication. And it doesn't have to be a problem. It's just part of the journey. Yeah, and in the, I think I just said this, but in the text, if you read the formal texts, you know, the traditional text about shamatha, they prescribe a very secluded, you know, space with no inputs, no disturbances, silence, no people, all that kind of things for people to really get into very, very deep states of samadhi. But it is possible. That is possible. But for most of us, When we practice, we're having a certain amount of thought phenomena going on. So a key of my practice in this area came from Joseph Goldstein. And actually, Sylvia Boorstein said that he said it, but I looked around and there's something he said, which is, nothing is worth thinking about. Joseph Goldstein, great Western teacher, nothing is worth thinking about. And it's a great line. It's like, what does that mean? Because we're just talking about thinking's happening. So how do you put that together? But it's subtle. Because thinking does arise, but then what do? And it's worth, in terms of what he just said, it's worth looking at what we think about and whether or not it's worth it and how deep it goes, the thoughts that are arising, kind of how deep it goes, because this is a critical difference. Because much of our thinking, the stuff that just floats up, it's about past and future. You know, we remember some old relationship, some phenomena, some situation. We start spiraling out on that. We go, oh, I'm practicing or futuring. We think about the future and what we're going to do. All those kinds of stories. We just tell ourselves stories. We're planning, you know, we may be looking ahead. We may be fearing, all that sort of aspect. We spend a lot of time not in the present, but rather in thinking about the past, thinking about the future in this light kind of frothy kind of way. And the same goes with good reputation and bad reputation and praise and blame. You know, we can really spin out on those things and that's not actually something we're dealing with that's of significant in our lives. It just pops up. So in terms of what Joseph said, there's one aspect, we just don't have to feed the beast. You know, when that comes up, we don't have, we can let that go sometimes. And in a light way, just go, oh, I realize I'm spinning out on this silly little thought that I don't need to be. And we can just drop it, you know, and just be mindfully alert to when this arises and just let it go. It's a whole different question for something that's really in our hearts, that's very, you know, a very painful circumstance or something like that. But in terms of the light stuff, to differentiate those, I think can be really helpful. That when light stuff comes up and it's just another memory of that time you went to Hawaii 12 years ago, you just don't have to do it. We can just let it go and put it down. And we find if we just put it down, it's pretty, not that hard to do. And then we can just come back into the present. So that line, nothing is worth thinking about, has been very helpful for me. I don't know about y'all, but it's been very helpful for me because it kind of reminds me there's just no point in this kind of discursive thinking if I can just drop it easily. So sometimes, you know, for me, I mean, little stuff will come up, but practicing for an hour or something, there'll be these poppings up during the course of it. And I've just learned that it's not bad. That's just what happened. It's just natural that it pops up. And if it's the light stuff, just go, oh, and then just consciously drop it and move on. But not in a tension, not in a wrongness. Just, it's like a ripple. And then related to this, as I know you've all experienced it, the way when some kind of random thinking comes up, a lot of times we come up with a new random thinking from the first one, and then we start spinning out into all kinds of associations. There's a word for that, many of you know, papancha, Pali word for that very phenomena. And that's something, it's great to have that tool to know, oh, look, this is papancha, you know, to kind of grab it right there. Ajahn Amaro, it's great, great Western monk, British monk, he says, papancha is the habit of buying into our thoughts, believing in them, and creating images of past and future, and going off and inhabiting them, building castles in the air and going to live there. This is what causes us so much distress. So, yeah, don't feel bad about it when it happens. Just recognize it. And that's the, you know, it's the beauty of mindfulness. So just say, you know, we can just say no thanks and just relax in a relaxed way. Not bad. That's where people often feel like, you know, something wrong with my practice. Thinking keeps rising. I keep thinking. It's like, don't do that to yourself. Just relax. And when you come back to the present, when you recognize, oop, I was thinking, laying back in your breath, celebrate that. And I always want people to encourage people to just celebrate these moments of mindfulness. They get you get kind of get lost, then you come back, get lost, come back. The coming back, that's the one. That's the one, because most people don't do that. They just do papancha. Most people you know, you get out there in the street with a couple of neighbors and it's just boom, 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 boom. Everyone's associating and telling, oh, this happened to me and that happened to me, and da, da, da. And it goes around and around and no one actually got mindful there. So, you know, it's okay. But the fact that we have this intention to come back, be in this present, that's so powerful. That's so amazing. So just keep doing that. The second aspect, which is harder but more fruitful, has to do with thoughts or thinking arising that's closely identified with our own personal sense of self. Stuff that's close to our heart, that's gritty, you know, it's gritty for us. We think this is me thinking, or this is my thoughts, or I'm thinking about myself. It's charged, it's powerful, has to do with our life. And these are more kind of driven and compulsive. We may find ourselves thinking the same thing over and over and over for years, or if in a particularly difficult situation or anticipating it, rehearsing, 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 or anticipating, 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 you know, it's very real. And you can't just turn it off. It's not like the first stuff you can drop. You can't drop it. It's, you know, likely or not, it's going to be there for a while. And then it may drop. It's not going to drop, but you probably can't consciously make it stop. Have to kind of like roll with it. And you may find, you know, this may be a place where walking meditation is appropriate to put your attention to your feet. You have to be kind of work with your skillfulness to what degree it may want to calm down for a bit so you can just be in the moment. But this may be your moment, is having these thoughts in our faces. That may be it at the moment. So what do we do with that? Because if we think we failed or just get lost in that stuff, we're pretty much derailed from the practice. We may just get up in frustration and go get something to eat, you know, or turn on a movie or something, because I can't do this, you know, forget it. But we can. Just there's ways to work with this. And this really gets down into the core of what the journey is here, and the journey toward freedom. Because the deal with this practice is it has to work no matter the conditions. That's kind of what we're working on. I know I've said this before, but one of my teachers once said, this has to work if you're lying in an ICU with a bunch of tubes sticking out of your body, you know? Otherwise, it was only half-baked. It won't really help us at that time, so we want it to. So let's, with this in mind, back up for a second, and we're kind of refresh ourselves about this tool of mindfulness and how it works and how it fits together. Because many of you know the Buddha taught the four foundations of mindfulness, and he suggested that we cultivate moment by moment mindfulness of every phenomena that arises through the sense doors. If you look at the whole expanse of the four foundations of mindfulness, there's nothing omitted. It's like every single sense door, every single phenomena, anything we experience, he's saying, be mindful of that. Oh, be mindful of that, and be mindful of that. So that's so wonderful, because it's not like the spiritual path is dependent on good conditions. It's the entire thing. And of course, we've in the check-ins, you know, good half of you got something rough you were up against, right? So it's got to work there. And the way that thing you're up against probably, I bet, emerges in terms of a lot of thoughts when you're sitting to practice, when you stop the taking care of, maybe you're a big part of your day is taking care of these things and working and the whole deal. Then you stop and this whole whoosh of everything comes and hits you in the face and all the feelings and all the stuff. And that's okay. That's beautiful. Not comfortable, but it's beautiful. And it is exactly in the core of what the Buddha taught, where freedom lies. So thinking, it's right there in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. One place you can think of it is in terms of in the the aggregates is a list of, there's the fourth foundation is five lists, and one of them is a list of the five aggregates, and volitional formations includes thinking, and there's also an element of thinking in the fourth foundation itself, which is states of consciousness. It's not exactly thinking, but they sort of interweave. So point being, the Buddha included the stuff that's going on. So the key is being aware of what's going on is the practice. And you know, when we're sitting here, this y'all didn't know, but we got singers next door who are like doing scales, this great choir thing, doing scales up and down during the practice. And it's like, okay, that's part of what we're being mindful of is the sound of the scales going up and down. If we're feeling irritated, then, oh, you can feel this irritation in your body, these thoughts of irritation or embarrassment or whatever, you know? So whatever it is, being aware of whatever it is that comes at you is your practice. And there's times when it settles down, you can just rest in your breath, and there's times when it can get really still. And that's incredibly wonderful when that can happen and when powerful kinds of insight can emerge. Other times, there's a chainsaw outside. There's a stream of thoughts in your heart and mind, and that's your practice. So I want to introduce a subtle shift in wording that can be very helpful, and that's to use the word thoughting instead of thinking. Thoughting instead of thinking. This comes from Gil Fronsdal, great teacher. And it's wonderful because it points to the fact that there is no self doing the thought activity. When the word thinking, the way it is in our English language, it sort of posits a self who is thinking. So right there, it frames it, subject doing thinking. It concretizes it around self out of the blocks. But if you think of it in terms of thoughting, then it's like, oh, wait, there's just this phenomena arising. It's no different than a chainsaw or the choir practicing. Thoughting's happening, choiring's happening, chainsaw's happening. There's a rising, and you're aware of it. But it's not me or you doing it. It's a huge shift. So it's really interesting to play with the word thoughting. Just bring it into your vocabulary and see if that works for you as you're working through the phenomena of thinking arising. Because that whole question of making, deciding, or thinking, coming to the conclusion that there's a self doing the thinking is a lot of what brings suffering for us. And to be not wedded to it, not identified with it, is where freedom lies. Because the practice, you know, the arc toward awakening, what the Buddha taught, it's that's the core, is mindfulness. The shamatha part helps us do that better. But the mindfulness is where insight comes. People can be very focused, and that's where the Buddha shifted away from, you know, the Brahmanic conditions around him. There were his own, the two teachers he studied with before he went off on his own, they mastered incredibly high levels of concentration. But he realized that wasn't going to bring insight. And he said, no, this isn't it yet. He himself used those deep levels, but the insight part is the magic of what Buddha Dharma is about. And as we cultivate mindfulness, even in the middle of a busy, busy life, we gradually gain insights. It emerges. You all have experienced that. You start to see through things. It's kind of amazing. Even if it seems like, oh, my meditation's not good, but it works anyway. And this is going to tie into the thoughts question, but we see what's known as the three characteristics or the three marks of existence. That's what insight is seeing those three. That's why it's called insight meditation. The three characteristics are impermanence, also translated by Gil Fronsdal as inconstancy, anicca, not self, anatta, and unsatisfactoriness or suffering, which is dukkha. And there's a real gold mine here. This is powerful stuff. And if thoughting, that for many of us, that's like one of the most pervasive phenomena we encounter in our practice. You know, I know some of you, you know, have physical issues and some of you don't. So maybe there's a knee or a collarbone. I'm sorry you had that accident. You know, being part of our reality, but maybe it isn't. But thoughting comes up to varying degrees for most of us, is one is for many people is the most primary phenomena they come in up against when they're practicing. And therefore, it's a primary area for mindfulness. It's, you look at it that way, oh, this is a doorway to be explored. This is a doorway to harness in our journey. It's kind of a gift. And to touch on these three aspects, the three characteristics with this in mind, like impermanence or inconstancy, which is a great word. Now, Gil's got a real skill of coming up with these English words that reframe things. Because it's, you know, there's this constant change. When we look at it through this lens, we realize that thoughts and thoughting, they're kind of the epitome of inconstancy. I mean, if we have a pain in the knee, we got a pain in the knee, there it is. But thoughts, they have this incredible motion. They come and go, especially the lighter ones that float up. You know, it's just kind of hilarious. I mean, we've all had this, if you're really going on, there's this thought and that thought popping up, and it's just kind of funny to watch it, like you're thinking about the past, you're thinking about the future. It's kind of like you're in a room where someone's throwing colored papers in through the walls, and you're kind of amazed to see what's coming through. So, and have you ever tried to hold on to a thought that's emerged? Can't do it. It's gone. Like, what was that? You know, they come and they go. They're completely evanescent. Other word, how you pronounce that? Coming and going, incredibly impermanent. And there may be a set of circular thoughts going on about some particular issue or some trauma or something we're working on or something we're afraid of. But even there, there's change, there's motion, there's different colors, different flavors. There's a real impermanence there. So if we really bring our mindfulness to whatever aspect of that is running for us, we can really start to see through our sense of concreteness around it. And a lot of times, the concreteness we have, that this is how it is part of what's hard for us. It's where we suffer. It gets coagulated and stuck. So when we bring mindfulness to our thinking, it's an object of mindfulness. And we can see with insight the impermanence of these thoughts. And in this way, we're seeing that they're impermanent, they're ever-changing, they arise in a stream of cause and effect. We're just kind of along for the ride. And then when we start to realize that all these thoughts are cause and effect and there's this whole process happening, then it becomes clearer, it almost arises from this, that if these thoughts have no inherent essence, then they're not mine. You can't claim it, because where'd it come from? Becomes obvious as we watch it that there's, you know, there's, each one of us has our own pool of thinking, and it taps into our life histories and all of that, but it's not, there's no me there. It's just a whole bunch of stuff accumulated, this huge basket of inputs. But it, when we bring our mindfulness to it and watch this impermanence, it becomes clear also there's no me there. It's not showing us me. It's just phenomena. It's like you get sort of kind of weirdly disconnected from it. I mean, you're present with it, but the sense of identification with it starts to fall away. It's just this, all those squirrels, you know, we're just watching the squirrels. And as that starts to happen, as that gets deeper, there actually is, there's a freedom there. Because when we thought it was us, then we got a problem. But when we start to realize it's just thoughts arising, and it's not me, because there's no coherent me there, intrinsic me there, it brings us into a freedom. And it leads to the third, which is, you know, freedom from dukkha. Because if the thoughts are impermanent and they're not me, then the heat of suffering that people have, the dukkha around their circumstance, it starts to fade away. It starts to disassemble. There's no self, me identifying. You can't grasp it. It falls away. And over, the Buddha, he articulates this trio as a key to freedom, to nibbana. And they're really available to us. You know, they self-reveal to us. And the SN 2245, that's Samyutta Nikaya, the connected discourse is 2245. The Buddha said, whatever is impermanent is suffering. Whatever is suffering is not self. Whatever is not self should be seen as it really is with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. When one sees this with wisdom as it really is, one becomes disenchanted. Being disenchanted, one becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. One understands birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. This is one of these wonderful articulations that the Buddha, many, many, many of the path and leading to nibbana, to the freedom that he found. But it's so amazing that this thing that we often think is a problem, these busy thoughts, is in fact a wonderful tool for practice right in front of us, inescapably in front of us. So just to review, there's kind of two things we've been touched on. One, thoughts are not worth thinking. And it's really something to bring into your practice. I think that phrase is so succinct and beautiful. You might try it out. Just write it down, a piece of paper, and see what comes up when you find yourself just doing random proliferation. And it may be easy to drop it in a mindful way. You know, it's not a problem, but just you can go, oh, yeah, don't need to do that. Don't need to do that, and drop it. And that does help us get more stable in our attention and move in a direction of stability or concentration, to be sure. More challenging is these thoughts that drive us, that grab us, that become us, the traumas, the visions, the pain, all these things. But we can bring these into our mindfulness practice and start to see that it's not any different than a pain in the knee or loud traffic. It's something that's pleasant or unpleasant. It's manifesting in our thought process, but the more we're aware of it, the less it grabs us. And then, he says, the Buddha said, he says, when one sees this with wisdom as it really is, one becomes disenchanted. Being disenchanted, one becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. I want to finish here with a short quote by Padmasambhava, who was a great legendary historical figure who brought the Dharma to Tibet in the 9th century. And it's a wonderful, it's one of my favorite teachings. It's called Pointing the Staff at the Old Man. The story goes that this old man, of course, says he was 65 and close to death, but I guess people didn't live as long back then. But anyway, he comes to the Buddha and he says, I'm near the end of my life and please give me a succinct teaching to bring me awakening. And it's pretty short, but one place he does say, within, whatever moves in your mind, whatever you think, has no essence, but is empty. Thought occurrences are naturally freed. When, remembering your mind essence, you can take thoughts as the path, and the practice is easy. So let's sit for a moment.